Welcome back to the second hour, Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Henry Frayne is at the controls. Tomorrow morning on the show in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll have an archive for you, a program that we first broadcast in June, a conversation with historian Robert Dalek, who has written biographies of Lyndon Johnson and more recently of John F. Kennedy. We talked about his recent book, An Unfinished Life, a biography of John Kennedy. And if you did not hear that in June, you'll have an opportunity to hear it tomorrow. Then we'll be back live in the second hour. The guest is Robert Zimmerman. He's an historian of space exploration, has written a lot about the American space program, also the Soviet space program, and we'll be talking about a recent book that he's authored titled Leaving Earth, Space Stations, Rival Superpowers, and the Quest for Interplanetary Travel, which looks very closely at the U.S. and Soviet rivalry in space, and I'm sure also we'll take the opportunity to talk a little bit about the U.S. space program and where it is right now and where it's headed. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Well, I think that it's true that most people will have a special fondness for the popular music of their youth, whatever that is. I think it's also true that when you think about pop groups, rock and roll groups that arouse high levels of passion in their fans and their followers, probably the Beatles got that response more than an awful lot of other groups. There are people, I'm sure, that will remember where they were the first time that they heard the Beatles. Or maybe if you're one of those people who saw them when they performed on television, you're going to remember that. And it's likely a rather important thing in your life. This morning we'll be talking with a writer who has authored a book about looking at this relationship. It's about the Beatles, but it's particularly about the relationship between the Beatles and their audience, and the extent to which those two things shaped one another, particularly the way the Beatles themselves were shaped by what it is the audience saw when they saw them on the stage. The book we're talking about is titled Magic Circles, The Beatles in Dream and History. It's published by the Harvard University Press and by our guest, Devin McKinney. He is a freelance writer. He mostly writes film criticism for publications, including Film Quarterly. Has had film criticism published in anthologies. He's also writing an article about the upcoming re-release of the Beatles album Let It Be for the American Prospect. So if you're interested in the Beatles or in pop music, you could certainly head out to the bookstore and take a look at the book, Magic Circles. And of course, as we talk here on the program, questions are always welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is, you know, just try to be brief so that we can get in as many folks as possible. But anybody's welcome to call 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. McKinney, hello.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. I'm interested in maybe to begin to talk a little bit about where your book actually ends, talking a little bit about your personal experience and acquaintance with this music,
mm-hmm.
because you are not of my generation. You're not one of those folks that would have had their first exposure to the Beatles when they first came to this country and played on television and maybe listened to them on vinyl 45s or on AM radio when they were still playing music on AM radio.
Right.
You came to it a little bit later, and I think in the book you note that you were, when they played their last live concert, you were only two. So you would have come to this music later. Tell me about how it is that you first became acquainted with the Beatles.
To pin it down even more precisely, it was actually a month after they played their last concert that I was born. So I'm even a bit more removed from it. But like a lot of people my age, and I believe of my generation, I first discovered them as solo artists when a lot of their hits were being played on, as you say, AM radio, when it still played music, back in the 70s. And I apologize for anyone who's read it if I'm saying anything that's redundant to what they already know, but I gradually became aware of this Paul McCartney, this George Harrison, this Ringo Starr, and they were all having solo hits on the radio in the early to mid-70s. And I gradually became aware that they had all once belonged to this group called the Beatles, and that there was a fourth member, and I never knew who that member was. until a certain point when I realized, yes, indeed, it was John Lennon, who I was also aware of, because he was also having hits and was also very much a dominant figure on the music scene at that time. And everything sort of snapped into place, and I began to see, you know, the enormity of the talent this group must have had. And that was when I started to become more interested in pursuing a knowledge of them as a group, as opposed to the soloists.
So what was it, was there a particular piece of music that was the first one that really grabbed you?
By the Beatles, per se?
Mm-hmm.
I would have to say, God, there were so many. I would have to say She Loves You, I think, is the one that has stayed, you know, dislodged at the center of my heart and my brain. I remember so many, there's sort of the standard Beatle canon of top 40 hits that have always been on the radio, like All My Loving and Hard Day's Night and Long and Winding Road, Let It Be, etc. But yeah, She Loves You. There was just something about that I found terrifically moving, and it just really shook my universe at an early age, hearing it on the radio. Later on, I had an experience of listening to Strawberry Fields on my first Beatle album, which was the first time I sort of made a decision to, okay, I'm going to experience this. I'm going to sit down and concentrate on it and let it do to me whatever it will do. And so those two songs, in very different ways, I would have to pinpoint as the earliest and most influential on me.
So I guess one has to ask about, we can go back and there are a number of things I would talk about, but
mm-hmm.
one has to ask about this music. What is it that keeps it going and keeps it going in the hearts and minds of people? You know, I'm sure that there are folks who listen to all kinds of music. There are people who are listening to old Grateful Dead tracks, and there are people who are listening to the progressive rock that came out of England, and there are people who are still listening to Jimi Hendrix and Cream and
mm-hmm.
and on. I'm sure there are people who still every once in a while like slapping in the Rolling Stones, you know, maybe they're listening to Paint It Black or something like
sure.
that. But it doesn't, all of that music just doesn't have the legs that the Beatles music does. And so you have to ask, well, what is it? Is it something to do with the music, or is it something to do with them? Is it actually some of both of those things?
I think it's some of both of those things. It's also several other things. The words they spoke, it's the way they look. It's the way they are together, the way they are separately. One of the oldest cliches about the Beatles is that the sum was greater than the parts, that if you put the four of them together, there was really a fifth entity, and that was the Beatles. And once you broke them up, none of them was ever quite what they had been when they were with the other three. So there's that aspect of it, sort of an alchemical reaction between the four of them. I've done a lot of thinking about this lately, and I really think that if I had to point to one thing, it would be the fact that they are so appealing to kids. I think that's why at regular intervals they've been able to pull in new generations and new sub-generations of fans, usually among kids who discover them at a certain age of coming into consciousness of the world. And I really think it's easy and, you know, perhaps impossible not to fall in love with the Beatles at that age, because they are so colorful, they're so funny, they're so beautiful to look at, they're so magnificent to listen to. And yet at the same time, there's an inherent simplicity about them, which is very akin to fairy tales and, you know, even Grimm's fairy tales, where there's a dark aspect to them. And I think kids just innately realize that these guys are with me, they're speaking to me, and yet they're not as simple as they seem. As I get older, they'll get older with me, and I'll always be able to discover something more, going back to that music and going back to that picture and that movie. And I really think more than anything that's it. They appeal to the youngster in us, and especially if we're literally a youngster when we discover them, they just have the ability to grow older with you, and in a way that perhaps other artists don't.
I think that one other thing that sticks in my mind, I know it's an important point to make, and that is going back to this idea that there were these four guys. There
mm-hmm.
was John, Paul, George, and Ringo, and then there was the Beatles
mm-hmm.
in caps, and that it wasn't very long before the Beatles crushed those four guys. And that was one of the reasons that they got to the point where they felt they could not be the Beatles anymore because of, and a lot of that, I suppose, had to do with the kinds of expectations and projections that their fans put on them. And for the four of them, who were, after all, just four guys, the weight of it was just too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's really the I don't want to say the journey, but the story that this book in particular tries to tell was how, what did the Beatles take from the audience? What did the audience take from the Beatles? How did each make something new of what they had taken? How was each influenced by the other? And how was this sort of acted out on the stage of the 60s, which was obviously the most, perhaps the most tumultuous time in living memory, in terms of the conflicts that were seen and the lack of agreement. You could point to, say, World War II, but I mean, I think the country was in accord over that war in a way it never was over Vietnam. So the 60s were obviously a time rife with conflicts that perhaps hadn't been seen since, you know, the 20s, perhaps even further back to the Civil War, internally in the country. Yeah, so I want to track the interplay, the alchemical, if you will, interplay between the Beatles and various segments of the audience, and what were the results of those interactions. And I found pretty early on that that was my theme, and also that a lot of these interactions were on the dark side. They were interactions that were having dangerous, volatile results. And that's where it comes to the point that you've just spoken to, where the Beatles felt themselves being crushed. They had to remove themselves from the concert stage. And in various ways, I think both conscious and unconscious, they started to dismantle their own celebrity. They started to create some music that was less in the mold of earlier Beatle music. They began to say things, particularly John Lennon, that he knew would upset a lot of people. They began to present images of themselves that they knew would be upsetting and that would contradict the sort of mop-top image. And it came out at the other end of the decade in some expressions that were very explicitly about death, and I think that had its prediction in the Beatles more or less trying to kill the image of themselves that had come up around them, and that they were saying it's time for us to grow into something else, all of us.
Our guest is Devin McKinney. He's a freelance writer. He writes mostly film criticism for a variety of publications, including Film Quarterly, but he's also interested in music and is the author of a book that's titled Magic Circles, The Beatles in Dream and History. It's published by the Harvard University Press. Talks about this very thing, and that is, it concentrates on the relationship between the performers and the audience and how they perhaps shaped one another, but particularly how the audience shapes the performers. And I think he makes the argument that when you look at pop music, that this phenomenon was more powerful with this group, with the Beatles, than maybe any other group. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have somebody here, obviously must be listening on the internet because they're in Arizona on our toll free line. Let's go there. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is Patty Troop. I have a living trust. Are you there?
Ma'am, I think maybe you're calling the wrong program. what is it? What is you're interested in?
I called 1-800-222-9455.
This is 800-333 WILL. So I'm afraid you got the wrong number.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, it could have been somebody listening in Arizona.
Oh, well. The magic of the random is part of life.
I guess. We have occasionally heard from people in as far away from California and other places because we are on the Internet. And if you are listening on the Internet, you could call 800-222-WILL or 9455. Hey, it could happen. And my the guy in the control room, Henry, is just giving me this look like, I don't know what that was. Okay.
Well,
anyway.
I hope this woman finds who she's looking for.
I hope she should redial and get to the right place. I'm starting with now. Let's go back to start where the book starts. And again, I guess I'm thinking of the people who, for most of them, their introduction would have been when the Beatles were established and on kind of on their way up. So mm-hmm. these were the folks who first would have seen them on television here in the United States or would have listened to them when they started recording and some of those early, very popular recordings. Going back a step, though, you say some interesting things about their origins and about how that made them the group that they were. And I think we have to think back to what Britain would have been like right after the war mm-hmm. and what their hometown would have been like right after the war. And it would have been a very grim place, amazingly yeah. different from what Britain is today, or would it would have been not that long afterwards. In what sort of way do you think that their growing up where they did helped to create what they were?
Sure. Well, I think you find in any society you look at that if the society as a whole wants to maintain a certain image or a consistency of mood, that a lot of times the energy, the unruliness, the discontent is pushed to the margins. And Liverpool, where the Beatles were born and where they were all raised, was very much a marginal part of Great Britain at that time. It was the center of shipping, but it was not the center of any sort of cultural life branched out into the country as a whole. And so it had to sort of create its own culture, which I consider to be an underground culture because it was so hidden and it was so non-mainstream. They were obsessed with American music, particularly jazz, particularly country western. They were also interested in West Indian Caribbean music. There were so many different cultures coming in on the ships and bringing new types of music. And I think this combination of jarring influences had an enormous influence on the Beatles. Also, John Lennon in particular spoke many times of how rough and grim and violent the city could be. It had been badly damaged in World War II. As we know, Britain as a whole was bombed. London was virtually destroyed. And that in itself, I count as had to have been an enormous influence on them. And I think Britain as a whole, my sense of it, reading the history, is that Britain was so traumatized by its experience in World War II that throughout the 50s, as the Beatles were maturing and coming into music, they tried to maintain a national mood of, okay, we've had too much excitement for a while. Let's not have any more excitement. And the Beatles were playing off that sense of a purposeful pull away from excitement. They were caught between that and what was going on in Liverpool, which was a very rough, volatile scene with a lot of influences coming in. And it was sort of, you're more influenced by two jarring influences, I think, than you can ever be by one straight-ahead, consistent influence. And I think that's where, in the Beatles, we get a lot of the shift between the mainstream and the very non-mainstream. And I think both of those may have had their influences in making their music and their personalities and their phenomenon what they were.
The other thing that's interesting about them is that right before their big breakout, after having played and grown up in Liverpool, they went to Germany.
Yeah.
And spent some time in Hamburg and playing there in what sounds like it was pretty grimy, gritty, grungy kind of circumstance. It's out of keeping with the way, with this later sort of lighter image, at least the one that they had when they first came to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, it's really interesting to think about these really kind of low down, almost gutter kind of origins, how that would produce this, you know, how this would go and produce She Loves You and this kind of ideal, but sunny, happy, suitable for child listening, kind of pop music that they made. It just seems a very, very odd to think of them playing in that. You know, when you read the descriptions of what that was like,
yeah.
It just seems very odd.
Yes, and that's one of the contradictions, and as you say, the just incredible oddities that we encounter throughout their career. How did they come from this place and wind up in this place?
Yeah.
How did they then wind up in the next place? I mean, from Hamburg to She Loves You is no weirder, really, than moving from She Loves You to Strawberry Fields. How did that happen? I think it can only be if you take into account all of these influences being thrown into the hopper. If you take a song like, And I Love Her, that's a very beautiful, it's as clear as white wine. It's a very straightforward and very affecting love song. How do you place that against Paul singing Long Tall Sally back in Germany to a crowd of drunken Germans? Well, obviously, And I Love Her did in some sense come out of singing Long Tall Sally in the Star Club in Hamburg, Germany, and that's one influence or one aspect of their art, their alchemical art, I keep coming back to that word, that I'm trying to track in this book. Specifically of their experience in Hamburg, it seems to me that that was the place where they first encountered their first great audience. And by that I mean the audience that pushed them into going to a place where they wouldn't have gone themselves and certainly hadn't gone before. If we listen to the recordings, the very few recordings that are still available of their time in Hamburg, you can see a very hot and very volatile and very immediate interaction between them and literally the audience that is sitting there at the foot of the stage. You have the Beatles playing ferocious rock and roll, very much in a rockabilly tradition, Elvis, even more Carl Perkins or someone like that. And you have the audience consistently shouting things to them, saying, come on, you know, if they have to wait too long for the next song, they shout, come on, let's have another song. And that's a fascinating sort of interaction where the Beatles, you can tell that their music is speeding up and it's becoming harsher, it's becoming sharper, and it's becoming immeasurably better because they're being pushed and prodded by this audience that is in a very immediate proximity to them and wants to be excited now. And that, I think, is more than anything the value to their later history of their years in Hamburg, the fact that they realized we're going to have to produce now and we're going to have to pay this audience off now and we're going to have to do that to every audience we encounter after this.
Mm. Yeah. I guess that's something that probably if you knew them just from recordings, even if we're talking about the earlier recordings, you wouldn't appreciate maybe as much as if you had ever had the opportunity to see them perform, particularly in a smaller kind of venue. Not the kind of things that these stadium concerts and huge shows that they played here, where everybody was screaming and you probably couldn't hear anything.
Right.
But something where a setting where you could actually see what the music could be when they were playing at their sharpest.
Yeah, unfortunately, most of us, even those of your age or older who were around for Beatlemania per se, most of us can only dream or imagine what that must have been like to see the Beatles in a tiny, tiny club.
Yeah. Well, we have some other callers. Let's see. Let's talk with someone here in Bloomington, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to say that first off that I was at the International Amphitheater in August of 1966.
Oh, my gosh.
And you could not hear anything. I think that's one of the reasons why they quit playing live is because the PA systems of the day couldn't handle what what the crowd was giving them. But anyway, I would like to say that I think the Beatles were special as the Beatles more so than later on as individuals, in large part because of the fifth Beatle, George Martin, and what he brought as a producer to their albums. And not only as a producer, but as a player, for example, in the middle of In My Life, that's his solo. And that's all I had to say, and I say thank you.
All right, well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, obviously a very important influence in the group's music.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the caller mentioned his harpsichord piece, or maybe it's an organ piece in My Life, but you could also point to Lovely Rita, his piano in that song, his piano on Rock and Roll Music and Long Tall Sally. George Martin was a fantastic rock and roll piano player. Who among us stops to think about that? But it's absolutely true. He cannot be overrated as an influence on them.
Okay, let's talk with someone in Savoy, line number 1. Hello.
Hello, I I've heard that somewhere out there exists a copy of The Long and Winding Road without all the syrupy strings, and I just saw advertised a new album coming out called Let It Be Naked.
Yes.
Do you know about it?
I'm sorry, the caller broke up.
Yeah, the caller broke. Is the caller still there?
Do you know anything about? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can now. Yes.
Okay. Do you know anything about this new Let It Be, and is it a stripped down version of their music?
Yes. Originally, what we've always known as the Let It Be album, a few songs on there were laden with strings and chorale by Phil Spector. This was in contradiction of what the Beatles originally wanted the album to be, which was, as you say, a very stripped-down version of just the four of them playing together, and occasionally a fifth guy, Billy Preston, the organist, who added some very nice touches to a few songs. But it was supposed to be a very simple back-to-basics rock and roll album, and it didn't wind up being that because it sort of got lost in the shuffle of the Beatles' breakup, and no one really cared enough to to shepherd it through the process of getting it out as it was intended to be. And this new release, Let It Be Naked, is set to be released worldwide, November 17th, and in the U.S. a day later, is an attempt to go back and correct that mistake. It's not exactly the album as it was intended to be in 1969, but it's a pretty close approximation of it, and it is very stripped down. And yes, there is a version of The Long and Winding Road without any strings, without any chorale. It's just the five Beatles and Billy Preston in a small studio on the very last day of these sessions. It's the version that's actually heard in the film, Let It Be. And it's, to my ears, and I think a lot of other people's ears, it's an immeasurably more beautiful version. The simpler it is, the better it is.
Good. I'll look forward to it.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are a little past the midpoint of this part of Focus. We're talking with Devin McKinney. He is a freelance writer. He writes film criticism and has this book. It's about the Beatles. It's titled Magic Circles, The Beatles in Dream and History. It's published by the Harvard University Press. And it is about the relationship between the Beatles as a group, their music, and their audience. And the way that they shaped one another, but particularly the way the audience shaped them. And he makes this argument that, that may happen a lot in pop music, but perhaps with this particular group, it happened to an extent that hadn't happened with anybody else and perhaps hasn't happened with any other group since. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. The title of your book, Magic Circles, comes from what apparently was the idea was supposed to be the title of the record that we know as Revolver.
Yeah.
They wanted to call it Magic Circles. And I guess here, in the United States, you hear Revolver, the first thing you think of is a gun. But I gather in England, when you say Revolver, that's another term for a record.
Yeah.
So they had something different in mind, maybe not the kind of associations that we have here. So the fact that you have made that the title, and also having looked at the book, I know that for you, you would say that in their career and in their music, Revolver was a very important, a pivotal point. Now, I suppose some people would say, they'd say it would be Sgt. Pepper's, maybe, or music around that point, or maybe it would be, once they started to make music like Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying, you got to go back just a little bit further. Look at that record and what was happening there, and there you can see at that point these musicians saying, "No, we're going to go into a different direction. We're going to be something else." Let's talk about that record and that time.
Revolver in particular.
Revolver in particular.
Yeah, well, that's sort of spread throughout this middle chapter that I have, which is it's a picture of the Beatles' journey through the year 1966, which was the year that they recorded and released Revolver, and how that music might have fed into and fed out of the things that they were going through in their real lives. I think Revolver is an album where the Beatles were much more so than on Sgt. Pepper, trying to go against the tide of the time. Against the tide of their own previous music. They were getting more into their each Beatle songwriter was trying to get more into his own head and his own concerns, and yet they came up with an album that at least gives the appearance of being incredibly unified, because each Beatle is contributing something to the other's vision. And if you listen to that album, at least with a certain pair of ears, you see that it's a very hard, very cold, very metallic, very, in a way, brutal album, despite having a love song and a children's song and a song about Indian mysticism. For me, at least, as one subjective listener, it's informed much more by a certain coldness of emotion, a certain paranoia, a certain uncertainty as to where we are and what we're doing and what am I to you and what you are to me. I think for all those reasons, it's a fascinating record, and it's one that you could chew over a long time. And I think Strawberry Fields really is, I think of it as being the last emanation of the Revolver feeling, whereas Penny Lane, I consider, which was recorded just after Strawberry Fields, I consider as being the first emanation of Sgt. Pepper. It goes in a much more uncomplicatedly positive direction. It's much sunnier, and it's much brighter, and it's a beautiful, beautiful record, but I don't think it has the sort of psychological depths that Strawberry Fields had and that Revolver had, where they were sort of lingering on the problems and the complications and the contradictions in their life. And they were making music that was very complicated and contradictory, whereas Sgt. Pepper, as great as it is, I don't think is great enough to be considered the Beatles' greatest album, let alone the greatest album ever, because it doesn't admit of that complication. Mm. It doesn't have a sort of psychological underside to it, where it seems a little too certain of itself.
Well, here I think it seems like a good example of, maybe you can tell me, but it's a good example of this issue of the influence, the way that they could be pushed by the audience. That is, here we have these two pieces, Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, mm-hmm. one much sunnier, one much darker. If you look at the way people responded to them, the song that people liked was Penny Lane. They were directed to the sunny side. They went to the sunny side. So, and it sounds like then what you're saying is the Beatles saw that and in a way they said to the audience, okay, that's what you want? Okay. That's what we'll do. And that then when you look at Sgt. Pepper's, that it's an album, I know you make the argument that it's an album that's technically very accomplished and yet doesn't have the same kind of depth to it, maybe that doesn't at least explore the darker sort of realms that a song like Strawberry Fields does, or that maybe then later material that you would find, particularly on the White Album, which is, I know, the one you think is the best.
Yeah.
So am I reading that right?
Yeah, you're reading it absolutely right. I would only flesh that out to the extent of saying I don't think it was a conscious decision on the Beatles' part to, quote, go along with the audience and give the audience what it wanted. I think this is an example of how they were almost preternaturally tuned in to the zeitgeist or the prevailing spirit of the time, is that they were recording Sgt. Pepper at a time that the Summer of Love was gearing up and that the hippies were sort of going in the Sgt. Pepper direction. But neither of these groups knew that the other was doing it. They just sort of came together in a divine synchronicity at the beginning of the summer of 67, and the hippies loved Sgt. Pepper. Sgt. Pepper fit in right in with it, what the hippies felt like and what they wanted to hear right at that time. I don't believe it was a conscious so much as an unconscious concession. The audience sort of wanting to go on a certain trip at that time, and the Beatles sort of being along with them and feeling like, okay, we can lay back, not be so intense, not be so troubled as we were on Revolver, and we'll go along with this trip. And I think in that case, it was more a Beatles audience not pushing each other to a new place so much as deciding to go with each other to a safe place.
Yeah. Taking a step back and talking again a little bit about Revolver, And I guess I want to go back to that point here where Beatlemania was fully in flower to an almost hysterical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Whether indeed that was, whether to what extent Revolver and the the darkness of that record, and perhaps at that point the decision to want to be something else or do something else comes out of their being troubled by, not really understanding, feel crushed by the insane sort of enthusiasm for them and their music that mm-hmm. they were greeted with.
Well, yeah, that's really the tension that I tried to that I feel exists, and that I tried to capture in this chapter about the year 1966 and what the Beatles were doing. I don't want to shortchange the Beatles' influence in pushing the audience, because the book is very much a give and take. It's very much half and half about audience influence on Beatles and Beatles influence on audience, because I think at various points they very consciously did things that they knew would either influence their audience in a new direction or revolt and repel the audience. For example, at the beginning of 1966, they posed for a series of photographs that had them covered with hunks of meat and broken baby dolls. And this one of these shots wound up being released in the cover of an album that was released in America and was inspired quite a controversy, as any fan out there will know. That was a very conscious decision on their part to go against the fab image and, okay, let's put something out there that our fans haven't seen and that we don't know how they're going to respond to. Later on that year, John Lennon made his famous remark, "We're more popular than Jesus now." He did not say we are bigger than Jesus. He said we're more popular than Jesus, which, you know, some people are still going to argue against that. I would argue that that may have been true. But once again, he was consciously letting slip a statement that he knew, he was not a fool, that he knew would anger a lot of people, and a lot of people are still angry about that. And so there's another example of how the Beatles, and one of them in particular, was very consciously doing things that he knew would push his audience in a certain direction, or not in a certain direction, but in a different direction, one that he couldn't control, that he couldn't predict, but that he was doing consciously. Hmm. A lot of it was unconscious. A lot of it was very purposeful.
Do you think that you understand the level of enthusiasm to the point of hysteria? I hesitate to use the word hysteria, but it seems like a pretty good word to describe.
Oh, I use it a lot. Yeah.
What happened and the way that people, and I guess maybe you wouldn't have to say people, that we were talking about young girls, adolescent girls, really. It seemed to me like they were the ones that were there screaming at all those shows. And so, to an almost obsessive degree, and a degree probably more acute than with other pop figures, although I guess we've seen some of the same kind of things happen with Elvis Presley and, you know, others. What that was about, and what about the Beatles inspired that to that degree?
Well, you ask if I feel I can understand that. I feel like I can only make an attempt at understanding other people's attempted understandings of it, because not having been a 15-year-old girl when the Beatles came over, that's the best I can do with it. And if you read the testimonials of people, male and female, from that time, you find that people don't understand what they were feeling. I wouldn't expect them to. I wouldn't expect the Beatles to understand what they set off. In terms of how the Beatles influenced, say, adolescent girls at that time, I think it was enormously sexual, and that's a very that's not an original thing to say, but I think, and I'm sort of treading on thin ice here, but I think a lot of us, male and female, who have responded in deep ways to the Beatles, we understand an edge of that response, the sexual response, and I'll let people, you know, go with that where they will. But I think that was an enormous part of it. I think girls at that time were seeing, and I don't want to get too academic on this, but sort of a picture of masculinity that they were probably not seeing too often in their day-to-day lives. I can speak mainly to America because I have a sense of how America might have worked back then. The Beatles' long-haired image, their high voices, they sort of embodied an androgyny that was not nearly as extreme as, say, David Bowie took it later, or Prince. But nevertheless was out of the norm for pop music or pop culture in general in the 60s. And I think girls responded to that as, okay, here's a new image of masculinity. Here's a man who I can have deep physical and erotic feelings for, but he doesn't embody the macho image or the sort of Wally Cleaver image that I remember from the 50s. And I think it was the physical and also the emotional aspect of combining a new form of the masculine image that, in addition to the music, that goes without saying, that drew a lot of female fans to them.
Yeah, and I guess also, you know, I wouldn't want to discount the how many guys would see them, and maybe unlike the women who would say that I want to be with them, guys who would say I want to be them, and how, you know, how many guys would have, young men at that time would have, say, maybe seen a movie like Hard Day's Night, and said, you know, I would like to hang out with those guys. I would like those guys to be my friends, or, you know, even taking a step further, said I would like to be those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe part of it would have had to do with how much attention they got from the girls. But, you know, I'm not sure what all else it would be. It's more than that.
It is more than that. And this is one thing I also tried to get at in the book whenever I could, was that the Beatles inspired other people to do their own thing. You mentioned Hard Day's Night. Many American musicians of the 60s, and I'm thinking of the Byrds and the Lovin' Spoonful and Jefferson Airplane, these people who later became famous as something else, had started out as folk musicians. They saw, because they thought that was pure and it was not commercial and it was not defiled by money. They went to see A Hard Day's Night. They saw that, and they saw that the Beatles were cool. They were not buying into the whole commercialism game, except to the extent that they wanted to. And they realized rock and roll was cool. And so Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, he went out and he got his 12-string Rickenbacker electric guitar right after that. And that's where we got Mr. Tambourine Man by the Byrds as a direct influence of A Hard Day's Night. And so the Beatles, yeah, again and again and again, they're not inspiring people to just sit there and wish, oh, gee, I wish I were the Beatles, and I'm not, so therefore I'm unhappy. Again and again, they inspired people to get up and say, I'm going to do this because I saw the Beatles do their thing.
Yeah, either, interestingly, for a lot of performance, either in opposition to that, in a sense of saying, you know, I want to do something different, or being inspired by that. So many musicians that heard the music of the Beatles and who said, wow, who were blown away by it and said, well, I want to do something like that, but if it's going to be mine, and yet that has inspired me to try to do certain sorts of things. So,
right. And if you listen to the Byrds, for example, there's a lot of Beatles in there, but at a certain point they very much broke away and became their own thing.
Yeah, or I guess I'm thinking of, for example, that one example that stands out in my mind is the Brian Wilson, who was so inspired by Sergeant Pepper's, and that he took that, and then what he came out with was Pet Sounds, and I think a lot of people would say for the Beach Boys that's a definitive sort of piece. So I'm sure that there were lots and lots of performers who heard that music, and either they said, ah, that's no good and I'm going to do my thing, or they heard the music and said, that's wonderful and I want to somehow try and do that myself.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to sort of go both those ways, but in a sense that the Beatles is the jumping off point, whether you say that's great and I want to do that, or that's not and I'm doing something else.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, it's sort of when you come down to it, I guess when you think of the various, the Beatles' various incarnations, you know, the different kinds of music they made early, mid, and late, and it seems kind of hard to pin them down, or is it? Is there something that remains consistent through all of those different places that they went?
That's a large question, and I'm consigning myself to foolishness by even attempting to answer it, but I would say that for me, once again, just as one subjective fan, one listener, I feel a sort of consistency of character throughout. Number one, they had a great work ethic. They never stopped working, never stopped recording. They recorded an enormous amount of work in the very short time that they were together. They were, up to a certain point at least, they were almost always out on tour. So there was a great work ethic. There was a great ethic of wanting to give their fans value, literal economic value for their money. They never put their singles on their albums except in one or two cases because they knew that fans would buy both, and so they wanted their fans to get the most for their money. That sort of character of always feeling like we have to give the fans the best we can give them, no matter how lousy we might feel right now, we have to work. That I find wonderfully consistent throughout their history. And that is like, it's like a steel rod running through the unformed clay of all these influences that were going on around them and in them. Their costumes changed, their facial hair changed, the words they spoke changed, their attitudes changed. Everything changed around them, but that implacable steel rod in the middle of, okay, we're here to work. We're not here to make an album every 5 years like artists do now. We're here to make two albums a year, two singles a year, do two or three concert tours a year, do a Christmas show at the end of the year, do three Ed Sullivan shows a year. That I think, that sense of we're here to work and we're here to produce and we're here to create, combined with a willingness to be shaped and influenced by all the unquantifiables that were flying around them. I think if you could pin down one hard practical thing that was great about them, that would be it.
Mm. Also, you know, one of the things that strikes me is the continuing, not only the continuing interest in their music, but the desire for more. When a few years back now, they went into the archives at Apple and dug up with some of these alternative versions, or the things that were put out on the anthology discs, where you could see how they thought about songs as they were trying different ways of doing them. I think there was always this great enthusiasm or this great belief that somehow there was music that they had recorded that it was never released.
Yeah.
That there was some sort of secret buried treasure somewhere. I guess it turns out that there wasn't. But that people are still looking for that. They still have this idea that there's something out there that I haven't heard.
Well, yeah, it depends on your angle. Once again, one man's treasure is another man's trash. For a lot of us, it was a treasure trove, simply because, not in the sense that there were oodles of finished, perfected songs that were as good as anything they had ever released. There weren't that. For the most part, they were very sound in their judgment of what they should and shouldn't release. For a lot of us, the treasure trove was the failed takes that led to the perfected takes and the conversations they had in the studio. And it was like seeing a great novelist notes and just being in on the creation of something that sounded perfect at the end. But you could see all the sweat and all the boredom and all the tension and all the creativity that went into it. And I think it was perfect that those albums, the anthology albums, came out when they did, because the original music has been around long enough and we know it well enough. So now we can go back and be in on the creation of it without having our conception of that original music radically altered. We can be in on the creation of it without feeling like the end result is, oh, it's just the result of all these failed takes. We can sort of see the finished product and the rough notes in isolation from each other.
Hmm. Well, there we're going to have to leave it because we've come to the end of the time. If you're interested in exploring this topic more, you should look for this book that we've mentioned. It's titled Magic Circles, The Beatles in Dream and History, by our guest Devin McKinney. It's published by the Harvard University Press. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure.